Evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on autonomousmedia.net, coming to you once more from east of the border, south of the river, live from the Jack Cave.
With seamless professionality all
the way. There you go, yeah, and that wasn't even me in charge of the buttons, there you go. So it's, I'm sure you're just mimicking my normal fine performance, Jack. Anyway.
Kind of live up to the maestro, so.
Well, we kicked off with some good long tunes there because a great supper was just being served as we went live, and fortunately we had just about enough time to get those out from under our belt. I thought we'd kick off with A Power Chord to End All Power Chords, and Speed King from Deep Purple used to be one of my theme tunes in the old days. And then we had Screaming Miss Jackson and the Slap Your Mama Big Band and Ain't Gonna Marry, which remains one of my mottos. And the Chemical Brothers, It Began in Africa, which of course is just a wicked rumour of some sort from their Come With Us album. Well, I normally actually try to approach this show with a good deal of preparation and research, and I make sure that I'm in a reasonable state to do it. Even when I'm at a festival, I'll work hard at making sure that I can actually do the job when the time comes. It's a little bit different tonight because of a kind of combination of circumstances, really. I've spent several years travelling relatively seamlessly on the...
That was just today.
Yeah, on the rail network. It's really not been a problem to me because I can kind of move around at non-peak times and all that kind of stuff, and it's worked pretty well. But today was a total blast. It was just amazing. Kind of made it out of Wales all right, but once I got to, I think it was at Shrewsbury, a company called London Midland, who were unfortunately responsible for most of my travelling ticket, cancelled a train because of a train fault, and I wasn't allowed to get on anybody else's. It was an hour or so before another one came along, so I got on that one, which was very, very crowded indeed, a bit like a cattle truck really. And we got on another London Midland train because we had to, and eventually that one coupled with another train, which took a long time, and we're having some problem doing that, and eventually it was decided that that one had a train fault as well. So everybody was kind of moved a couple of platforms along into a train that was smaller than the one from which everybody had been shunted. And then when we got on the underground, there was what was described as a passenger incident at West Ham. It was necessary to get the police in to sort that one out, and everything kind of ground to a halt. It was brilliant. It's taken hours and hours and hours. I think I should have been here about 40 minutes past 16. In fact, it was well gone 20 when I arrived. But there you go, that just makes it really good value for money, doesn't it? Because it means you've got more time and more variety for what passes for cash that you've handed over. So that's... There wasn't a lot of room necessary to get the kind of laptop out and, think about what was going on and stuff. So that was one thing. The other thing is that we've just been for our annual left-field trip to Glastonbury, me and Synchro. And regular listeners to the show will know that I talk occasionally about these ceremonies that we're involved in, known as the template, and that, for me personally, they've made a huge amount of difference. We realised this year that it was 1999 that we actually started this process with what appeared to be a one-afternoon kind of hit that absolutely, definitely changed my life, and you can kind of go back through previous podcasts to find that. It is unlikely that particular experience will be removed as a major turning point in my life, if for no other reason than this show really was spawned from research that resulted from that afternoon. It was the first time that I really heard about a world management team back in 1999. It was the first time that I heard about organised paedophile networks in amongst the corridors of power. And there were several things about it that I remember recoiling from at the time and thinking, everything else you're saying sounds fine, but that sounds really a bit crazy. And because Synchro and I still use the original introduction, that thing that we first heard in 1999, we still use it unaltered to this day because it was so exact about the situation we find ourselves in. And that includes especially recognising that all the things that really I was uncertain about when I first encountered it all those years ago, I now know absolutely to be pretty much down the line, and find myself wondering how it was that so much was known 20 odd years ago, and this still seems to be bubbling to the surface now. And as I said, it's been a very, very long unwinding, this one. So basically this year we were in there and we had two new ceremonies that we were doing for the first time. They were ceremony 12 and 13. I'm not going to go into the technicalities at the moment. Some point in the future maybe I will. But basically we're working at energetic fractal levels of the job we were doing way back in 1999. And this particular weekend was very powerful indeed for me, and I think for Synchro as well. The actual ceremony had about as much impact, I think, as ceremony one had on me, and as such I'm still, I think, kind of landing from that, still feeling a bit phased. One of the interesting things about it is that the geometry, which again when I talk about it in more detail I'll put some pictures up so that you can see it, is absolutely huge, really beyond description, and is concerned specifically with relationships between the sun and the earth. And as the more observant of you will remember, that was, that as it happens, was exactly what I was talking about on the show last week with reference to the suspicious observers, was how it is that the sun is now believed with very, very good evidence to be actually affecting the lithosphere on earth. So it's responsible, a causal part of earthquakes and volcanoes and the like, but also for the weather which accompanies these things. And this is fairly typical of my experience of the template, because for me to have actually done a radio show just last week on the subject, which turned out to be exactly what the geometry and the workshop and everything was about a week later in Glastonbury, is significant. All those times I've mentioned these little synchronicities that happen, this is a pretty good example of one of them, really. And actually, if for that, I'll always...
See, now, I would actually define that as a reverse causality.
Right, okay.
Rather than the synchronicity. That possibly the doing the show on it was what then projected forward the reality that then expressed itself.
I would tend to agree with you, except that the geometry is so huge. Let's give you some idea. It cost them £6,000 to ship it to the UK from Bali, where it was made. It's about 4 feet across.
And of course, yeah, we're actually talking about physical structures that's it, here, yeah, aren't yeah. we? This isn't like,
no, no, this is an actual
mathematical.
No, it's it's
an object.
Actually, a pair of devices. There were two of them. The biggest one of them involved all of the combinations of the dodecahedron and the icosahedron as they grow, and the other one included all of the cube and octahedron. Right, so they were really huge, and somebody had spent a long time thinking about it and even getting them here. So the two things occurring were really great. But the other thing I think that's particularly striking about this is that the paedophilia thing has been growing and growing over the years. And one of the things that we've been, Synchro and I have been watching, is the enveloping of this Pizzagate story. Which for those of you who, if you've been watching mainstream media, and we've asked a few people to check it out, you probably won't have heard of it. And it basically involves some kind of pizza shop in Washington, D.C., where there is pretty certain evidence of kind of child trafficking and paedophilia and all manner of other things which have been investigated and reported by many people. Now, of course, that's related for me to the ceremonies, because that's where I first heard about it and just recoiled from the idea, and still really find myself recoiling from the idea of even looking at it. But it's kind of tied in, really, to the work that we do here, because it's really becoming apparent now that some of the most authoritative stuff that we've been watching on it, and particularly I like David Seaman's YouTube, he used to work for the Huffington Post, but was unceremoniously dumped when he started writing about Hillary Clinton's health. Well, he's been really pushing the Pizzagate story, the story about these children being abused by senior government officials and trafficked and all the rest of it, using a pizza parlour as some kind of really shaky cover. And he's now having his YouTube videos removed. Now, all of this is being done whilst people like the Washington Post and the New York Times and the BBC are doing documentaries and running stories about what they're calling fake news. And it seems to me that perhaps our usual classification as conspiracy theorists is being changed, because what one of the things that struck me is it's happened quite quickly, a bit like the change from global warming to climate change. We've now got this sudden change from conspiracy theory to fake news, which frankly, coming from people like the New York Times, the Washington Post and the BBC, it's got to be something that's worthy of comment, wouldn't you think?
It's certainly a linguistic programming attempt by every appearance. Personally, having looked at the Pizzagate stuff as well, I smell a rat to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that the blatancy of some of the alleged points of disclosure, like people's Twitter feeds, well, first and foremost, a Twitter feed is probably about the easiest goddamn thing to hack. So you cannot say for certain that because something appears on somebody's Twitter feed that they personally have posted it there.
Yeah, that's got to be a fair point.
You also have the fact that any legitimate story effectively would receive absolutely no air whatsoever from the mainstream media. When they don't want a story publicised, they simply don't mention it, because for the vast majority of people, if it isn't in the mainstream media, it's not a story.
Well, that, from our obviously very small and random sample, seems to be the case. The people who are watching only the mainstream media don't seem to have heard about it at all. And also, on the first point,
my point there is that my suspicion is that because of the names who are being associated with the defence of this, it smells to me like a PSYOP, CIA op to promote new clampdowns on the internet, which is constantly a battle within between the cyber community, the hacker community, and the Congress.
Interestingly,
since 96.
And the same argument is, of course, being put forward for the coverage of Hillary Clinton, and they're suggesting that this fake news campaign is what caused her to lose the election.
Just on the subject of Hillary Clinton, I saw quite an interesting analysis of all of it, her strange spasms and aberrations, physical aberrations during the election campaign, and comparing them to those suffered by the last known tribe of cannibals.
Really?
Mm.
I find it interesting.
I just thought it was a peculiar little thing.
Well, it is, yes.
A tangent like that.
It's kind of worth perhaps putting on the shelf for later.
Yes.
Having said that, I'm interested in this discussion, interested in your point of view on this, because interestingly, there was that little run of stuff that they all clipped together, and loads of people did things about Hillary Clinton falling on her nose going on the plane, and various other bits and bobs. Well, there's been no new ones. It's not like it's still happening. For the Pizzagate thing, obviously, I'm not an investigative journalist. All I can do is listen to what people who...
Well, my suspicion is that with the whole pedophilia scandal, that the effort since the initial breaching of the subject with the likes of the Jimmy Savile disclosures and the beginning of Operation Yew Tree and its broad publicity in this country and various American scandals like the... I completely forget the guy's name, but the Washington kids being toured around Washington after dark scandal, is that we are possibly now having a whole bunch of fake smoke trails being thrown up as chaff, effectively. So we're having people thrown in front of the wheels, the sort of wheels of media, who are known to have no connection with pedophilia whatsoever, but are just tardy enough characters that the public will be prepared to believe it of them, even if it's not true, because then they can be held, they can then be their names can be cleared in public, and then the campaign against them can be used as a stick to beat the alternative media.
Yes, well, I'd suggest that's the technique that's been probably employed and has been working so far. But at the same time, what's happening as a result of all of this is people are digging into all sorts of places, because that's the thing, isn't it? It shows you some rocks that you can turn over and have a poke at.
Very much so.
And we know that the
people, and it's also definitely changed in the public's mind the preparedness to accept high-powered paedophiles, which was something. I mean, when I first went public with my Monarch stuff and began talking about like the stuff that I knew about Ted Heath and the Craze and Jimmy Savile and the like, that I knew historically way before any of this began. I mean, the Jimmy Savile stuff was all over the East End of London from the mid-70s.
Yeah.
That was like public knowledge.
I think Cyril Smith was also pretty well
very
known.
Very much
for...
so, yeah, yeah. And all the sort of various sort of Catholic choir boys and public school boys was all, again, you know, I mean, firmly within the public domain. But when I first went public with my sort of elite pedophilia stuff research that I'd done, I was met with incredulity for quite some years from even quite enlightened close friends.
It has to be said that one of your more frightening pieces was what made me actually look into it the last time I looked into it.
the cult stuff.
Well, yeah, indeed.
I'm sure that Mydrin is currently busy posting the video in the chat box.
There was some...
actually, before we go any further, sorry, chat box. And we've got the situation with this new chat. With lots of people stuck in the lobby. So we're showing a lot more people online in the chat than are actually showing up in the AM chat. So if you're online and if you're listening and you can't manage to get into the chat, on the website, on the page that you're listening to us from, in the bottom left-hand corner, if your chat is minimised, there'll be a green tab with a number next to it. Currently reading... What's that reading? Can't read it. Currently reading 20. So we've got 20 people who are all logged into the chat, but we only have 11 of those have made it through to the actual chat room. So if you click on the little green icon in the bottom left hand of the screen marked AM chat, and you'll have a pop-up come out of the left hand side of the screen, which will have at the top chats, friends and recent, and just below that it says AM chat room with a little house logo. If you click on the AM chat room, you will then be taken through to where everybody is actually chatting rather than just in the foyer.
Yeah, it's great. It's nice in the foyer, but it's better in here. It's warmer. We've got the heating on.
And people are actually talking to each other. Unlike in the foyer, where everybody ignores each other, much like they do on British public transport.
We can see you arriving. Obviously, those were clear words of advice. I see people popping up now. And talking to people in the chat box, I'd like to thank whoever it was that was in last week. It was my very first ever troll. actually, probably wasn't one of mine. He was probably really one of Ben Davidson's from Suspicious Observers. But I enjoyed that. It makes me feel that I'm doing something useful.
Man, I've even had other hosts that have trolled me in the past.
On other radio stations,
I might say.
Some hosts are famous for it, Jack.
Yes.
Let's just wind this back.
So essentially, we're looking at a situation where we have clear evidence of a number of historical cases where top-level parliamentarians... A-list celebrities have been shown to be directly involved in paedophilia. Now, whether that was organised and what do they call it? Paedophile ring is the term that they always use. Whether this was a legitimate paedophile ring that were handing these children around, or whether this was just simply individuals pursuing unnatural predilections towards sex with minors.
Well, one of the things that's come up as a result of people looking into that are actually some BBC documentaries on that very subject from a while back.
Well, certainly, I mean, the worst case scenario, in my opinion, would be that the Secret Services for years, initially used things like homosexuality until the legalisation of homosexuality. Once homosexuality was, in fact, before homosexuality even, they used adultery. So with heterosexual targets, they would basically target them with attractive younger women who would do their best to instigate them into adulterous affairs, which could then trash their name in the public domain and be used against them to control their behaviour. When adultery became almost passé, then we went to exposing of homosexuals and the public outing of homosexuals as the threat that was held over the various people. Mm. Now, with the legalisation of the Homosexual Act, we now have it being turned to paedophilia. And it's the sort of worst case scenario is that the Secret Services have used these three techniques for probably hundreds of years, probably going back to John Dee and the instigation of MI5. You know what I mean? So this could be like a 500-year-old practice of using that which you would be too ashamed to have spoken about in public, used as a control method to ensure that anybody that you place into a position of power and authority has a dog chain permanently around their neck that you can yank in at a moment's notice. So the other suspicion there would be is that when we do see somebody who is outed and placed in the public domain for this sort of activity, the chances are that they're one of the people that are basically having their chains yanked.
Mm.
Yeah? And in which case, we're probably being misdirected, and the real villains, the real criminals, are the ones that are doing the chain yanking.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from on that. At the same time, I know we haven't got many cause for hope in this particular line of thought, but do you really think if people were to find out what, I mean, effectively we've been saying is happening to the children, or a good number of them, I accept they kind of adultery has been legitimised and homosexuality has been legitimised. Do you really think that paedophilia could be legitimised in the minds of... Mind you, there's plenty of people who are handing their children over apparently willingly.
That would be more the monarch cult side of my research, is where this would be some form of initiation, like ritual initiation to the power elites, being done through a mechanism not entirely dissimilar, let's say, to circumcision, where it wouldn't necessarily be considered or conducted as a sex act. It would be perceived that way by society, by mainstream culture, but the actual practice is in fact considered by the practicers, by those practitioners, as nothing more than a religious ceremony of sorts to inculcate the initiate, the newborn child, into the existing religious hierarchy.
More clerical immunity.
Well, yeah. Mm. But I certainly have enough evidence of this being pretty closely linked with the behaviours of a lot of social services, especially in the so-called child protection role, both historically and currently, where it would appear that many of the social services, especially in a lot of the poorer parts of town, appear to not be established for the protection of the children of those poorer parts of town, but in fact to ensure that the more attractive, more desirable children, if I can put it that way, are extracted from the protection of their parents and placed within the state system, which appears to be a mill designed primarily in its current sort of configuration to allow an easy mechanism for these predatory paedophiles to satisfy their, should we call them, unnatural sexual predilections.
Okay, so the Pete's get. I mean, you kind of look at all the stuff that's coming out on pizza.
And is what, all I'm suggesting
what,
caution.
What people, yeah, absolutely. What people are publishing on their Instagram accounts and stuff. You just kind of look at it and you think, well, surely it can't be that obvious. However, what's happening as a result of it is that people all around the world are now looking into this, and I mean, they're seeking out interviews with Ollie Damagard, for example, who says, like you do, yeah, well, we've known about this for 20 years. Now, the thing is that somehow, when it gets to the critical legislative level, the evidence has been disappearing. Now, whether the, this pizza shop itself is a kind of smokescreen or not, what is happening as a result of it is a lot more people are looking into something which we're pretty much acknowledging is happening between us.
Yeah.
You know, now the thing is that when I first came across it, it was with through the MK Ultra and all that. I did those two shows on mind control planets and the gods, I think, and it went right away from this subject, right the way out to the mind control of the Sumerians and the religions and all that. But, and then I came across, as you know, Sandra Fecht, who I was down, when I came to see you last time, I was going up to spend a couple of days with her at a seminar. And this is where we come into the other side of it, isn't it? Is that the appearance of it to the public, in as far as it does appear to the public, is it's presented as satanic ritual abuse. That's what they call it, SRA. It's even got its own little acronym.
Well, I mean, well, first of all, let's, before we even go into the satanic ritual abuse side, let's just cover the act of pedophilia itself, because in the public's mind, it's considered a sex act.
Yeah.
It's considered as some sort of perversion of the natural predilections of people to engage in sexual activities that have gone wrong.
In fairness, I don't think people even think about what it might be.
Well, possibly, but certainly having been an advocate for many, many victims of pedophilia now over the years and become unpleasantly personally acquainted with many, many stories of the actual victims as direct personal testimony, it strikes me that none of this is actually anything like you or I would consider to be a sexual function.
Mm.
This is an act of violence, this is an act of domination, and it's beyond anything that the person who is engaged in a normal kind of missionary stance sex life for most of their life in a heterosexual couple could ever imagine to be within the realms of sex or sexuality. So that in and of itself is something that needs to be compartmentalised, is that there's this constant effort from the sort of paedophile advocacy groups to normalise this behaviour as if it's a natural consequence of the innate sexuality of children and the willingness of some adults to gratify that, whereas it really is not at all. This is all about sexual violence, generally speaking, sexual violence of men against children, and as far as I can tell, generally speaking, as a compensatory method against their own abuse, violence, hideous upbringing. So it certainly, it's not what people think it is. And then when you now add on to that the satanic ritual abuse side of things, I think we're getting into entirely different territory again, because that definitely isn't sex in the normal context.
No, that's
even if you take it at face value, even if you take it as described, yeah. That's not sex.
Yeah, I think that all of this is a fair point, but it's a bit like before people can even begin to think about what it is, the recognition that it is happening has to happen. I find the idea that that might normalise this behaviour absolutely abhorrent, but unfortunately, when you look at the state of the planet and its people, we have normalised mostly abhorrent behaviour.
Well, yeah, and to that point, we have also criminalised some elements of entirely normal behaviour in the name of protection against paedophilia. Because I would suggest that there is nothing unnatural about a 14-year-old girl and, let's say, a 24-year-old boy finding love and spending the rest of their lives together from those ages, and that that will go back into time immemorial, largely borne out by girls maturing much quicker than young men, and that if a mature young girl meets an immature young man, relatively so, then it's entirely appropriate for that age gap. There's nothing unnatural there, yeah, and that we're talking about completely within the bell curve of normal human behaviour, and yet that relationship would be entirely illegal.
Yeah,
well, and would result in the prison sentence for the young man involved, even if the young girl had been the one advancing all of the engagement.
Well, of course, for some reason, we do appear to be engaged in a game which endeavours to identify things as either black or white.
Very much so, binary.
And to pretend, as far as people like we're concerned, that shades of grey don't exist. But then again, when we're talking about MK Ultra and maybe this pizza shop with its ping pong tables and all of that, what is that if it's not more than 50 shades of grey? You know? And what about, you know, if... I mean, I still find it very difficult to imagine why John Podesta would have put all of this stuff into his emails, which seemed to be the thing that set it
really going. I think it's fairly clear that John Podesta appears to be a pretty scuzzy character, and that, again, I think possibly easy to believe suspects of little consequence are possibly, you know, I mean, a good one to throw into this mix. It may well be that this is the grand disclosure event. But I've just seen so many grand disclosure events come and go now without any major sea change that I'm no longer encouraged
by their
exposure, and I'm more suspect because of it.
And we've seen several of them recently. It was only, I think it was, can't be more than a couple of years ago, that several hundred bodies of babies and young children were found in a cistern in Ireland, which did hit the mainstream media, and then just vanished. But that's
Cote de Lorraine, the ridiculous suggestion that these children's skulls were somehow half coconut shells that had been identified by the forensics team that had been there before. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like stretching credulity, somewhat. And the fact that we have that, I mean, one of the things that I've tried to do is I've tried to disregard the truth or lies of a particular scenario, and I've tried to just log data points, and I've been doing that for a lot of years now. And one of the sort of repeated data points that seems to come up is the connection of children's homes, nefarious goings on after dark, usually involving the mass medication of the occupants of the children's home one way or another, and that many of these stories seem to link back into sort of underground facilities under a lot of these children's homes, and a repeated sort of bulldozing of the premises as soon as this achieves any sort of light of day. But again, we appear to have had another psyop placed over the top of those initial revelations years and years ago. And this was, in fact, subject of a book about the claims of satanic ritual abuse amongst a bunch of American nursery nurses, which you may remember, which again include stories of tunnels, satanic symbols, and was effectively traced back to a particularly rabid marshal and his desperate desire to believe that satanic ritual abuse was real, and him planting the in the imagery in the children, the alleged children victims. You probably can't hear that through the microphone, but my son is currently cursing.
Always like, always like a bit of background noise, always, especially when it comes from Jack's place.
Obviously, says. Sorry to disrupt such a serious subject. So essentially, we have what appears to be another one of these potentially laced media stories, because that whole public media story was going public at the same time that a whole bunch of other stories with similar sort of scenarios were breaching in the alternative media and in the sort of news feeds and the online news feeds and stuff, which never made it into the media. So it strikes me that that one that you did see in the media was intentionally laced in.
Yeah.
And was designed specifically to attract all of the attention to this one scenario, which is known to be false.
Well, that certainly happens, and I mean, it brings us to another, because it's one of the things that occurs in private eye every few years or so. You get to realise that there is another of these investigations into what's always called satanic ritual abuse, and no evidence is ever found.
Well, I mean, let's go. I mean, we've already discussed MKUltra, but one of my primary concerns with this whole focus on satanic ritual abuse is, first of all, when you go actually studying the religious connotations of the sort of language that you're using, Satan, Luciferianism, Satanism. First of all, the characterology, the anthropomorphizing of evil incarnate into this characterology of Lucifer, of Satan, of the devil. Well, first of all, those three terms are not mutually compatible.
Certainly not.
We appear to have three completely separate paradigms within that. Luciferianism has been around since Christianity. Luciferianism is essentially the counterpoint to Christianity, which appears to be in the nod about the fraud of Christianity and uses the power of conversion. So by showing indoctrinated devout Christians the fraud of their religion that they are devout unto, you have the sort of indoctrination of conversion.
Yeah.
And then basically anything that you say thereafter is accepted to be true. Yeah. Once you've unindoctrinated somebody into a falsehood. So when you go looking into Satanism, the actual practice of Satanism actually first arrives with Anton LaVey,
yeah,
and the Church of Satan.
Yeah.
Anton LaVey was a director of the CIA. He created the Church of Satan, and we don't have any existence of anything that remotely approaches satanic worship until that date. We then very shortly after have His Satanic Majesties with the Rolling Stones,
yeah,
Paint It Black, yeah, and yeah,
and the Satanic Bible,
and you know, I mean, Led Zeppelin with all of their mythical
sigils,
occult wisdom. So we appear to see a clear meme being placed, which again appears to subvert the Luciferian message.
Certainly does blur the edges, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. Well,
it never occurred to me to think about it in these terms.
Well, the thing is that Luciferianism appears to be humanism under a different cloak.
Yeah, okay.
So
yeah,
it's very difficult to actually see any real harm in Luciferianism unless you happen to be a Christian. Luciferianism appears to be primarily based on most of the Gnostic and Hermetic texts, which are probably incredibly useful pieces of information that were entirely subverted when they were conscribed to the Apocrypha.
Yes, indeed, and then kind of rescued, as it were. So that's
again, we have to.
And this is Blavatsky's stuff.
We have Blavatsky again sold to us as this proponent of Luciferianism, as if Luciferianism was somehow connected to Satanism, when in fact Blavatsky was the establisher of the Noetic sciences. And
that's what I was getting at, because there's quite a lot of, because of this confusion, Blavatsky finds herself, as they say, debunked.
Mm. Possibly quite rightly so. Certainly some fairly suspect elements to her work.
The people I know who are following that particular path are really, really good, honest people who are doing a pretty good job, I reckon.
Mm. Well, essentially, I mean, the point that I'm making is that, I mean, we just referred to the creation of the Apocrypha. Well, it was Constantine in the Second Council of Nicaea. Was responsible for the separation of the historic biblical texts into the accepted biblical texts and the Apocrypha, which was the basically banned biblical text that you could be burned at the stake for daring to read, and the only people that were allowed to read it were bishops and the likes. When you look into Constantine's life, well, Constantine was a Mithraean, and through his entire life worshipped a temple of Mithraeum, a temple of Mithras, and in that Mithraeum was a 30-foot golden statue of Mithras with Constantine in the character of Mithras. And when I've gone looking into the Mithraean mythologies, mythos and practices, it again comes up as what appears to be a rather radical version of humanism, when in fact the character of Mithras isn't some archetypal mystical god, but is in fact the man standing in front of you at the front of the Mithraeum who has the most status within your personal kind of group, and is elevated beyond their normal human status because of their elevated status.
Seems to me that the message in all of that is that that power is exactly what lies within us. You know, that that if we were concentrating on what it is we're here to do and what we actually are, rather than concentrating on a whole load of stuff which doesn't appear to be directly related to us, we'd all be doing a lot better.
Just to continue this Anton LaVey and the Church of Satanism and the connection with the CIA, and especially placing it within its historical context of the 60s, is that essentially we have this Luciferian origin underlying the counterculture. When you go looking at the origins of the hippie movement, Luciferianism is absolutely the rejection of the culture is the direct meaning of the counterculture.
Yeah,
and if you're in a Judeo-Christian culture, then the rejection of the culture requires a shedding of the paradigm of the Judeo-Christian overcoat that you've been born into carrying with you.
Mm.
Hence the adoption of a lot of Luciferian principles. And I would suggest that the Church of Satan was in fact intended to harvest the more shallow thinkers within that mindset
and
redirect them down a line of thinking that was purely pure fantasy.
It's again something we see a lot, is the kind of
the framework for one of the elements of the MK Ultra program, which was fake Satanism.
Mm.
and that from my researches into the MK Ultra, one of the primary mechanisms that they used during their admitted programming was the fake ritual, the fake cult.
Yeah.
And the reason why they would use this, along with Alice in Wonderland and alien abduction scenarios, was because if the victim managed to escape halfway through, or managed to remember half of what was being perpetrated on them, that their recounting of what was being done to them would be seen as so incredulous to any authority as to never be questioned as being a real event.
Yeah.
And would be always dismissed as a completely fantastic event. But that each of those has its own cultural, powerful paradigm deeply implanted within the Western cultural mindset. And that's why those three, we have the nonsense poems, the Alice, Lewis Carroll, and who is the other guy doing the Lear?
Yeah.
We have that world of nonsense and of fantasy, which is deeply embedded within the sort of childhood psyche. Yeah. We then have this creation of the Christian myth, and in fact, we see the whole concept of Luciferian or Satanist really is evil. There's not really, if you actually look at all of the other world religions, apart from the ones that are based on the Judeo-Christian religion, i.e. Islam, Judaism and Christianity in its various guises, you don't actually see an evil incarnate.
No.
Shiva is not evil.
No.
Shiva is the necessary consumer of its own creation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's not given a binary. Mm. Yeah. And so the very concept of satanic requires a pre-belief in the Christian paradigm.
Yeah. Fair enough.
And so once you reject everything about the Christian paradigm as being fraudulent and as a Romano, as a Roman construct by way of replacing the centurions and the Roman army in their global thing, that they replaced them with a priesthood, which were a lot fucking cheaper because they wore sackcloth and ashes and were quite happy to live in drafty bloody castles in the middle of nowhere. So my fear is that everything that is associated as satanic is intended to drive a certain section of society back towards the Christian faith.
So it's basically a repeat performance of something that we see happening a lot, which is basically basically ghettoising heretics by giving them just enough to attract them. Thing is that if what we're looking at is the thing is that MK Ultra didn't really stop, did it? And I presume they're still doing similar things with better tools. In fact, I know they are. But quite apart from anything else, you can now run something pretty much. You can run something pretty much like MK Ultra just through the television.
Well, I mean, I would go MK Ultra is the carrot that the alternative media has had dangled in front of it, and I would suggest that actually is a grand deception, because when you actually look to the roots of MK Ultra, you find that the MK is from mind control with a K, which was a reference to the Nazi German paperclip connection of the MK Ultra program. And when you look into the roots of the MK, the Nazi German mind control program, that has its origins in Operation Pinocchio from the Italian Nazi secret service. In fact, sorry, not Operation Pinocchio, Operation Marionette. Mm-hmm. Which was supposedly an Italian invention, but guess who taught the Italians it? MI5.
Really?
And so we actually trace the true origins of the entire MK principle back to MI5.
Well, it wouldn't be surprising to find that it came from the same nation that invented concentration camps.
Yes, very much so.
So, well, before we have a couple of tunes, what we're basically saying about these, because, you know, there's a lot of work being done, one of the great things about being around now is that when people look into stuff, they can pull together information from ages and ages back. I think what we're probably saying about these citizen journalists is they maybe need to look a little bit harder or look with a different set of lenses.
You need to drop the preconceptions. You have to enter this.
That really brings us to one of my primary objections to the way that all of this is handled, and we talked about it a bit with what I call the great going away of buildings, because I don't think 9/11 does it. Now, you see, everybody who's talking about this is calling it hash Pizzagate, which is totally, totally inadequate. If everybody that was talking about it was coming up with their own description of what they were discovering rather than using this helpful little kind of two-syllable meme, we might be making a lot more progress, because maybe people don't realise how seriously they're constricting their own ideas just by adopting other people's language.
Well, the hashtag would be a Twitter link.
Yeah.
And would... I actually have never used Twitter. I have no idea how it works.
No.
But from my gleaning of how it works, the hashtag essentially adds something to a subject matter.
Like it makes it a label that everybody can add to.
Yeah, so essentially, if you were to search a subject on Twitter, you would search Pizzagate and everything that had been hashtagged with Pizzagate after the hashtag.
I mean, that just,
you would see within that feed.
That just really opens up the obviously. All of those. Everything about Twitter is designed to constrict.
Well, that's what I was just about to say, is that within 120 characters or less.
Unless you're a hacker.
Which is hardly... I don't think I could have even written a sentence of 120 characters or less about anything that I found out about Monarch.
No. No. But it is... I think... Because there clearly seems to be... At least there appears to be at the moment some... an actual head-to-head between the alternative media and the somnolent mainstream. And I think that in itself is an interesting part
legacy
of it.
Legacy media. I heard it called the other day.
Legacy media.
I think I'm going to use that one. The legacy media.
So shall we have a bit of music? Shall we listen to that one that's called The Beautiful Ones?
The one that I queued up just while you were talking about doing your intros.
Yeah.
Professional, as I always am.
Yeah, there you go. But
let's do that, shall we?
Suede, The Beautiful Ones.
Are we going to continue into some Dr. Feelgood?
I think we probably will, continue into some Dr. Feelgood,
so
then we'll
back
come back.
In about 6 minutes. Yeah. And I expect all of those of you that were loitering in the lobby and not made it through to chat, if you've not worked out how to press on AM chat yet, I mean, we're going to, like, rip the arse out of you when we come back. Anyway, that's just me.
Dr. Feelgood and back in the night. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on autonomousmedia.net, where I'm live with Freeman Jack in the steaming heart of UK PLC. Welcome back, Jack.
I like that steaming heart.
So we've got plenty of people in the chat box, so I'm going to say hello to you. I am. We've got Andy. We've got Andy Young. Hi, Andy. And Nick Nomick, how you doing, dude? Tony, playing the tunes before the show there. Really cracking tunes. Needed something to relax me, mate. You did a good job. Some guy buried up to his neck in the wood. Dr. Rock, Freeman Jack, Jay. Hi, Jay. How's it going down there in the kitchen? And Keno and Lubilu and Midrin and Patrick, Sam, Sturm, Synchro, yo Synchro.
Hey, Synchro!
Hey, and guests, hello, 102-692-738-744 and 875, if you want to welcome all. That's all.
Yeah, but those lot haven't made it into the chat box.
Well, that's okay, they can still hear me.
Yeah. I still think we've got to take the piss out of them, though. I mean, it's pretty goddamn simple. We have raised the numbers slightly.
Yeah, indeed. Well, it took me a while to find my way into this chat box as well. But I'm
yeah, we're all noobs here.
So, it seems that all the stuff we were talking about earlier and these layers of... Because that's basically what we're talking about, is different layers of information and how far you can penetrate it. It really reminds me of we did a kind of a vision quest at an Out of the Ordinary festival we were at, where the idea was where people could come and talk about where they'd like to see things going generally. It's a sort of optimism seminar, if you like. And there was a guy there who must have been in his 70s, and he was really, really enjoying the whole experience of the festival and all of it, and this thing was kicking off on a Sunday afternoon. He said that when he was brought up in the 50s, everything was grey. People were dressing in grey, and the diet was tedious, and lots of things had changed by the time he got to the Out of the Ordinary. But he said that he had, since his time in the 50s, and especially in recent years, felt several times that he was actually approaching what he might have considered calling a level of enlightenment. But he said each time that occurred, he finally realised that all he'd done has penetrated another layer of bullshit. So you keep finding yourself actually standing, relatively speaking, in the same mire as you were, no matter how much looking into it you go. What other major stunts do you think are being pulled? That, I mean, the paedophilia thing is evidently real. What it is, how widespread it is, how people are going to respond to it if they actually do find out what's actually happening are all kind of moot points. But it's not just that subject. It's not just there that the wool's being pulled over our knob, is it?
No, well, I mean, if we just take the reference that we were just using with the satanic ritual abuse being associated with the Alice in Wonderland fantasy programming scenarios and the alien abduction scenarios. So essentially we have this this meme being promulgated within the sort of public realm, especially through programs the likes of X-Files. I would suggest that about 10 years ago the entire spectrum of the American documentary channels that are available on Sky all as a singularity began broadcasting ancient alien theory bullshit shows, all with the same speakers on. And so we have this promotion within the public mindset of the existence and the reality of aliens from outer space. Within that, we have, in much the same way as the sort of satanic ritual abuse side of things, we have an element of reality. First of all, we have the actuality of the sexual abuse.
Yeah.
We also have the actuality of this sexual abuse perhaps being contextualised by the abusers within some sort of ritualistic role, either to ameliorate the abuser's guilt, to associate it with something other than their distorted perceptions of sexuality, or, like I say, as part of this sort of mind control program to intentionally inculcate the victim within this framework that's inexplicable.
Yep.
But essentially we appear to have the same thing being conducted using the alien agenda. And I would suggest that probably 90+ percent of all alien reports that you have ever come across are government created in one form or another. Either that the real object that you saw was some deep black military project that they're not telling us about, as we know with the delta shaped UFO what do you call it when there's like a spike in sightings of a particular shape UFO, and that was all around the few years leading up to the publication of the
stealth,
the B2. When you see a B2 in profile, it's triangular.
So I know Stephen Greer's claiming that it's all man-made, isn't he? Including whatever aliens are being seen when he claims.
Artificial alien.
Not up for that.
Well, in my model, this is the seat of creation. In my model, it would appear that the universe is being projected from this place out, and so I see very little. I see very little possibility for some super advanced race to somehow ride that wave of our projection outward,
back in,
back down to impress itself on us. No, I honestly.
But do you reckon they're out there doing their own version of what we're doing, or do you think they're just alone here?
I honestly think that consciousness. How deep do you want to go? Consciousness is singular, and we experience a singular consciousness as individuated consciousness units, as if consciousness were a hand and we were the fingers of that hand. And somehow we appear to be emotionally and intellectually segregated from our unity, our singularity, and only experience our existence as an individual and not as a collective.
So like I say, one planet, 7,000 million different worlds.
Kind of, yeah. But essentially, my pursuance of holographic reality theory suggests that any conception of reality as something as being real is misplaced. That if the paradigm of the primacy of consciousness is pursued to its ultimate conclusion, then there is no matter. There is only mind experiencing itself, experiencing. And in which case, everything that we perceive as out there, we've put there.
Yeah.
And to some degree, that mindset was instigated in me long before I ever came across any simulation theory, holographic reality theory, digital holographic reality theory, holographic universe theory, all of the various flavours that are emerging. I suspect that probably 4 out of those 5 are actually smoke screens to cover for the one that's actually the real explanation of reality, but no, especially simulation theory, because that just appears to be a bigger, better version of God.
But digital virtual holographic theory does look like simulation theory.
The two are very closely... I mean, the one thing that I would suggest is that digital virtual holographic reality theory, a la Tom Campbell's My Big Toe, first of all, I suggest he's wrong. Did kind of suggest it to him in the show, which is possibly why he didn't come back for a second one.
Should have left it for the second one, Jack.
Possibly. I'm not the sharpest of implements.
We got him on the first time, that was quite a triumph.
Yeah, well. But yeah, I would suggest that the simulation part of DVHTR or whatever it is a metaphor, is a very useful metaphor, that it's easy for all of us in the computer age to imagine the computer jockey sitting at his terminal playing his game of The Sims or World of Warcraft or whatever, and completely embedded within the actions of his avatar on the screen and almost entirely unconscious of his human form sitting at the keyboard in front of the screen.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of simulation theory part of digital. But like I say, I would suggest that that's probably a good metaphor.
Mm.
Whereas in actual simulation theory, they tend to go more for, well, the specifics of simulation theory are that the universe is in fact a simulation being run on a super advanced alien race's supercomputer.
Hmm. If what you say is right, though.
Bullshit. The alarm starts clanging. Oh dear, we have to have God in this equation.
It kind of slips a little bit beyond
Judeo-Christian. It's another Judeo-Christian science overlay over a region of science that is becoming undeniable.
But if what you say is right, all we've got is metaphor.
Certainly, that it removes objective reality. And so all reality becomes subjective, which is certainly something. I even go to the point that I used to sort of promulgate that the only objective reality was thought itself, and so your belief in your existence was the only objective fact. But I would suggest that's now fairly subjective too.
Has this kind of changed your approach to shopping and people and things? Has it made a difference to the way you do things, realising that it's all in your own mind?
I don't get so pissed off with other people for shit. If I'm pissed off about something and projecting it onto me apparently being pissed off with somebody else's actions, I intersect that thought with the knowledge that at least 80% of that perception is entirely my own creation and entirely at my leisure to experience as an unpleasant emotion or as a pleasant emotion.
And that, I think, is a really, really important point, because it's a subject that we've hit on several times over the years, is that most people don't realise that what they're seeing is largely a projection, a reflected projection of themselves.
Even completely disregarding the holographic reality stuff, the simple perception science that's coming out of MRI scans and CAT scans and the likes, and the study of mind science, we can now definitely say that our high definition experience of reality, of being able to achieve crisp focus on some external objective thing, yeah, is actually created by our mind and has very little to do with the actual experience of perception. That perception is incredibly low resolution, and that the most minor of signals are involved in the actual acquisition of what we think of as reality. And the vast majority of the high definition, the high resolution reality that we experience is in fact an overlay that's constructed by our mind from what we expect to be there. And so in circumstances where the mind is entirely engaged in the activity of tracking the known, the unknown can appear within that scenario and be completely invisible. And the example of this is the experiment where they got the subjects to watch a video screen of a basketball match, where the basketball is being passed from player to player, and the subject is asked to track how many times the ball changes hands during the scene.
Mm.
And the majority of subjects were only able to track a certain number of ball passes, but the one thing that all of the subjects managed to miss was the fact that the man in a gorilla suit walked across the court halfway through the experiment and is completely unseen by every single subject of this experiment because their mind is entirely occupied with the divining of the number of ball passes and engaged. So,
and there's another important clue as to why there's so much distraction for us.
Well, essentially, we're in the cognitive dissonance there, that your brain is so deeply engaged in the task of the counting and of the mapping of the ball movements on screen that a man in a gorilla suit is entirely invisible.
You see, I think there is an argument that could be made which suggests that people are so busy keeping track of this and that and the other and the money and the what have you and stuff that they haven't realised what depraved outlets are being found for the nominal tax money and things like that. Their moral presence is being kind of somehow subtracted.
Mm. Could be misappropriated,
yeah. Or effectively kind of switched off, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, we certainly seem to be subjected to some sort of a selective programming, and the study of the mind sciences is certainly feeding into the practices that they're deploying for it. I mean, again, my guilty confession is to have been party to a PR company training the chiefs of industry how not to make themselves look like arseholes in front of a TV camera. And so I was familiarised in a most direct manner in the nature of the representation of news as a contorted variation on reality, even down to the fact that the people who appear to be being asked questions and who you might expect in ordinary circumstances to be giving answers are in fact engaged cognitively in the process of avoiding answering anything and of making sure that no information is actually passed, but that in fact perception is the only thing that is displaced through their appearance. So, yeah, we're definitely, I mean...
So, is there any point in watching or listening to any of it? Aren't you just better off dealing with...
I watch TV like one might watch a coiled snake in the corner of the room. I mean, one has to recognise an adversary.
Yeah.
And if that adversary places themselves within a framework within which they can be surveilled, I would suggest that it would be prudent for all of us to at least spend a modicum of time surveilling the public sort of head of the Leviathan.
Do you think so?
Yeah, yeah. I detest television. Elaine will tell you. I mean, I'd struggle to make it through an entire program of any nature. But yeah, I will force myself to sit and endure whatever propagandizing is being endeavoured simply in an effort to be able to analyse the nature of that propaganda and where it's driving. I mean, this is essentially what we're talking about here, is social driving, where concepts are placed within the public framework to confine, corral, and to create a public mindset about that subject. And so again, I mean, this is we were going to touch on sort of the alien abduction scenario, and how this can sort of play into the government's hands in scenarios like MKUltra. Essentially, if you need to lift somebody out of a public position and either debrief them to get whatever information they've got, to reprogram them if they've been subject to some prior programming treatment and then been let out into the wild, expected to do run their program.
Yeah.
If the likes of your Britney Spears start shaving all their head off, all their hair off, and screaming about "Don't touch me,"
otherwise cracking up,
in public, only to then go into rehab, for a few months and come back out with long blonde hair and
to be rehabituated,
very much rehabituated into the wearing of tight leather thongs and spreading of one's legs in a public place. So essentially it would appear to me that the alien abduction scenario has possibly been used as a meme to cover for extraordinary rendition. That we see extraordinary rendition now as a sort of an admitted practice, that the lifting of certain people from situations, especially if the laws of that country aren't necessarily the laws of the country that's doing the lifting, i.e. the United States and anywhere else in the goddamn world, it seems, is fair game. That to cover that with, you know, I mean, black helicopters, big searchlights and men in silver suits, would mean that if the abductee were to ever escape from their capture or to remember any part of it after being subjected to some sort of hypnotic programming, that their stories will be even less credible, should we say.
Well, disregarded almost entirely straight away.
Easily dismissed.
Yeah. So, the... So you were saying that you've met people firsthand and spoken to them who've experienced sexual abuse. Have you ever met anybody firsthand who's been abducted by aliens?
The peculiar thing is that the three people that have ever approached me directly about direct potential abductee type scenarios, all three of them were convinced that they'd definitely had some experience, that it appeared to be corroborated by peers, family members, other people who were there then, to one extent even to a newspaper report from the time. And it, all three of them came within a few weeks of each other, and all of them remained entirely unconvinced of the alien part of it. That while everything had the archetypal alien abduction scenario thing hung over it, one specific one was an Australian alternative web radio host that approached me after I went public with the Monarch stuff. And her story in particular was peculiar because she was another one of these children of the military base. Father in the military, growing up on various military institutions.
Very often the case.
And hers was a pregnancy that vanished.
Yeah.
And her efforts to try and get to the bottom of it.
Okay.
And her her disappearing pregnancy appeared to be absolutely wrapped up in sort of alien abduction type scenario ideas in her head, but her efforts in the real world to pursue the medical evidence of what had been undertaken proved to her that this was nothing to do with aliens, it was entirely to do with her bloody government. And she was exactly like the other three, where they were all convinced that something had been perpetrated on them, that their experience of it had been of some sort of an alien scenario, very similar to the X-Files and all the various memes that we see, going right back to, you know what I mean, it came from Mars and the rest of it, War of the Worlds. And so, yeah, it would appear that the acceptance within the public domain of the partial acceptance of the existence of aliens in amongst a broad dismissal of the subject simultaneously.
Doublethink.
Very much so,
Which again, the cognitive dissonance is an immobilising force, really.
Well, and honestly, had any of those three personal testimonies have presented themselves to me in their unrealised form, had they have all presented themselves to me as convinced that this had been a real alien abduction with little men from outer space having taken them up into their spaceship, one could conceivably see how all of their stories would have been completely dismissed.
Mm.
And yet all three of them, because of their rejection of what appeared to have been being done to them, and their questioning...
Did they all look into it?
There were some pretty extraordinary... The guy whose story had got into the paper, that was a pretty strange one.
What happened to him?
Well, with him, it was a light in the sky, or light come through the bedroom window, him and his older brother, very young, sort of 8-9-year-olds. And of something having happened that night, of the sister probably having witnessed it but not having been party to it, of the one brother thinking it had purely happened to him, and then when he finally broached the subject with his siblings, turned out that it would appear that it was something that had happened to both of the younger brothers. That the sister had probably been witness to the sort of abduction event to some degree, and it was only on the sort of comparing of all the stories that this chap began to suspect that something other than having been abducted by aliens was what had actually occurred, and that he suspected that perhaps this was some sort of a paedophile type scenario that had been dressed up in some sort of a pantomime drama to distort the events in the victims' minds.
So he must have looked at it when he was a bit older, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think his was actually going public at a sort of UFO type conference. And coming off stage and being met by somebody that remembered the story having gone out in a local newspaper about the sort of lights in the bright lights being seen. Odd experiences, UFO sort of connections being put out within the press.
Yeah.
Which, again, may well have been part of the cover story that was required for whatever he'd been victim to, shall we say.
Well, it does have to say that, I mean, I think as far as everybody's concerned, it's kind of hearsay, and that there is no, I mean, given that nothing is objective anyway, there is no hard objective evidence of the physical existence of aliens. But by the same token, if we were to look at the ritual abuse thing and the various investigations that have happened in that worldwide, we'd say there's no physical evidence for that either. Although you and I have both come across good first-hand testimony about tunnels being buried and that kind of stuff.
Again, most of the sort of personal testimony that's come my way has been more of violent disregard of the victim. Yeah. Rather than anything that's been really sort of cult oriented,
violent disregard. You know, if you're going to look for a couple of words to describe the way things are currently being run, then violent disregard would be as good a pair of words as any.
If effectively my postulation that you don't get into the halls of political power unless you have already been subverted by the mechanism of paedophilia, or, you know what I mean, the various sexual...
There's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because they've been sacking people from making people redundant from the county council in Powys, where I am. I think practically since I arrived there, and because of the size of the county council and the fact that more or less everybody who works in the county actually works for the council or an organisation that's kind of arm's length or not far off from it, one can't help but feeling that the people that are choosing to take voluntary redundancy are the ones who are not necessarily the most compliant.
Mm.
And some of them are really radically non-compliant and they go actually quite early.
Mm.
But then you get to the point where, you know, a lot of people that are in there have seen a lot of people go and they've been doing a job that they enjoy of one sort or another. And then somebody turns up and says, well, hey, you know, if you're going to stay working for us, you've got to do something completely different, which they might not enjoy doing. And that sees to another layer of people who aren't one way or the other willing to do things that they don't want to do.
Mm.
So you can see how quite innocently you could actually shave away a whole load of people before you get anywhere near doing what you're kind of talking about. But it's the same sort of drift, it seems to me.
Well, essentially what we're looking at here is a system that looks like it's been playing out now for many thousands of years.
Yeah.
And I certainly track this back into, possibly like you, into Mesopotamia,
yeah.
Sumeria.
Yeah. But I feel it must have popped up there from somewhere else because it happened so bloody quickly, you know, and so entirely, really, strictly speaking, 650 years. I'll tell you what, should we play a couple of tunes?
We're running out of... We've got Tony to follow us up, so...
Oh, great, excellent. Tony's coming on. Oh, brilliant, that'd be good. We can sit here and drink beer and listen to Tony.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that gives... So we've got... Oh, I've got barely 10 minutes to play some tunes. So
Have we? Or is that... Oh, am I thinking about mine? I'm thinking about tomorrow night, aren't I?
Normally, we're kind of fairly...
I'm thinking about tomorrow night. Ignore me. Tony.
I haven't got any playlists.
Well,
I'll tell you what, let's play a couple more tunes and come back with a bit of where we think this leaves us.
Yes.
We're going to play a couple of tunes really from the sort of 80s, I guess they are. Let's kick off with the Don't Bang the Drum, Do Something About It, Waterboys. That was Levellers and Battle of the Beanfield, and this is Dr. Rock's radio show on autonomousmedia.net, live with Freeman Jack, who now is back
The
Internet Radio on Friday nights between 9 and 11, doing his new show, Psycho Nautilus.
featuring Dr. Rock on this week's Psycho Nautilus. Yeah.
Welcome back, Jack, that's all I can say. Well, okay, so... So there isn't anything objective about it. It's all some kind of wave that we're projecting out of our own heads. And one of the things that we managed to project out of our own heads was the Battle of the Beanfield, which was really just the start of the horror to be followed by Grunwick and all the rest of it. Surely it needn't be thus. What can we do with this kind of self-created illusory smog that we appear to be living in? Is there anything we can do to clarify it a bit for ourselves?
Be your own person as much as possible. The primary function of the mainstream media is to create uniformity and consensus, fake consensus, in fact.
Consensus, in fact.
Well, uniformity primarily, and yes, consensus as a function of uniformity. And so the first thing that you need to start to do is to question everywhere that you conform automatically. And when you begin to examine your own behaviours in the context of a dispossessed third-party observer, so you have to separate yourself from your own emotions and you have to really become like the third-party observer, like the person looking over your shoulder at your life.
Imagine somebody's filming you.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then begin
I'd rather not think about it, actually.
And begin to examine how many components of that reality are of your own fruition and how many of those are being suggested or promoted by external agencies. And that even if you personally don't consume the mainstream media, as we like to call it now, legacy media.
Legacy media, we like that.
Yeah.
Prostitutes.
Yeah, prostitutes, yeah. That we begin to grow closer to an authentic existence. That the more we can identify of our belief systems as having been placed there by somebody with intention that wasn't to enable our agency within our own reality and to conscribe and confine our activities to those which were desired by that agency.
Difficult idea to start looking inside yourself and find out which ideas are your own, given that you've been brought up in a culture with a set of traditions.
Well, I think if you start from the assumption that they're all implanted,
well, that's pretty much what it looks like to me.
It more or less is. I mean, they're all culturally implanted. I mean, even you go to the concept of a dog, and we have this construct of dogness, which is attributed to all dogs, regardless of whether it be a Chihuahua or a Great Dane. And somehow from childhood we learn to discern this thing that is dog. And I would suggest that had we been left to our own devices, we would have probably identified several distinct differentiations in that thing which we now associate as dog. And the creation of that goes right back to your parents, to your mum. And who's the first person that points and goes, dog, 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 doggy?
Well, also, I mean, to a certain extent we can recognise that.
Is that you?
There's a doggy, yeah, there's a doggy.
There is a doggy bashing into the microphone and creating all sorts of chaos.
To a certain extent, yeah, thanks for the real demonstration there, Tubby, that was great.
Yes.
We do it to a certain extent, though, because we distinguish between dogs and foxes and wolves, say. So you're just suggesting that process might have gone a lot further.
I would suggest that it actually extends into almost every aspect of human thought, that almost everything that you think of as being your own thoughts is actually presented to you at some point in your childhood or adolescence and becomes incorporated into that which you believe to be your own thoughts.
Yes. Yes.
To some degree, this is one of the places, the real genuine uses for the consumption of psychedelics is the ridding of oneself of the ego self and That's not very
prime. I was trying to be fucking stealthy.
Yeah, like, when are you ever actually not going to appear in a show? Sorry. It's tradition.
Yeah.
Again, completely shredding
yeah,
my
the
mind.
Taking of, the taking of psychedelics and the loss
of
the ego.
Yeah, just the loss of ego self that's possible, almost inevitable, with enough consumption and the ability to suddenly realise that the constructed self is not you. And I think that this is actually what twists most people's noodles when they do finally have sufficient psychoactive substances and manage to distort their perception enough that the loss of the ego self is probably one of the most dramatic experiences that most of us go through under those sort of things. The sudden arriving at a... yeah, like an external view of yourself, because that's really, you know what I mean, the ego self is the constant sort of internalising of everything, the me-ing of everything, and I think that's one of the things that the psychedelic experience can do, is to rid you so much of your sense of self that it can make you actually presently aware of what parts of you are the authentic parts and which parts of you are the overlay that's in the imposed self.
Yeah. I remember encountering that in myself because I was brought up when the Vietnam War was happening and there was a lot of really crazy stuff going down. And I remember that some students got shot at a protest in America.
University.
Yeah, and my dad seemed to be all in favour of that. He was just kind of, you know, product of his generation and all of that. And so I got in my head this idea that the killing of students was a good thing, and it was a while before I realised that wasn't actually my idea.
Mm.
That wasn't actually what I believed at all. It was just, and then I've actually found a whole load of political ideas in my head that I'd just kind of inherited from my parents. So, in fairness, although it's sort of put down there in layers and some of it might be a bit difficult to identify, I reckon when you start this kind of exercise on the surface, you might find quite a surprising number of ideas that are not actually your own, that when you stop and look at them, you don't actually wholly hold with what you appear to believe.
I would actually suggest that the majority of people have never actually experienced an original thought. And that's not in any way denigrating them, because I'm not even entirely sure that I have. And despite my
God, if you've not had an original thought, Jack, we're all doomed.
Well, I'm constantly convinced that I've somehow thought of something that has never been thought of before, only to find some historic context where somebody has obviously at least approached the idea before, if not necessarily had exactly the identical thought to mine, they're pursuing the same.
We do seem to be in a pattern of discovering things and then forgetting them for 1500 or 2000 years and rediscovering them.
Well, I think not even so much the 1500 years, I think.
It was about 1700 for Galileo, wasn't it? He was still getting into trouble for stuff that they had actually uncovered kind of more or less a couple of millennia earlier.
Well, yeah. That would be a surprising revelation that the planet was spherical.
You suppose they'd have put him down as a conspiracy theorist and a fake news nut.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that what it basically boils down to is the same thing as we keep coming back to so often, which is that to whatever extent it is that we're making this reality, and you know, it's a creation, a creative projection of ours, to whatever extent that's true, we need to be taking responsibility for it, because we're actually affecting the way our reality manifests if we try laying that responsibility anywhere else.
Yeah, well, again, this dials back into this reverse causality, that it would appear that our focusing of our attention on any subject certainly peels off various layers of the onion, and appears to not stop. So there seems to be something peculiar about the focus of human attention. And that if holographic reality theory holds water and is a meaningful model, I mean, I've got to qualify this, I don't use the holographic reality theory construct as an absolute description, as a belief system upon which I construct all of my other assumptions, as a framework upon which to construct my assumptions. It's simply a model against which I present theories, and if they fit, then I find agreement, and if they don't fit, then I find question.
That's what metaphor is.
Yeah, and to some degree, I think that it's possible that the consideration of reality is beyond the ken of complete understanding of the human mind. So to some degree, we're only working within the understanding of the bit that we can know, a bit sort of Donald Rumsfeld. There are known, there are unknown knowns, and there are unknown unknowns.
I think the only gauge can be the place working on the things where you can see an immediate effect.
Absolutely, yeah. Sphere of influence. That's my primary concern now. Is that we attend to our sphere of influence, and if something is outside of our sphere of influence, then it's meaningless to divert our attention to it. Or if not meaningless, it's of lesser value.
Little consequence.
Lesser value, yeah. It may be a great consequence.
Yeah.
Because there's many, many great minds who have applied themselves to fairly, I mean, fringe...
Yeah.
Considerations and have come up with great revelations, but I think for the majority of people with the majority of things, that their focus of attention is beyond their sphere of influence, and ergo entirely wasted as such, and that they would be far better off confining their attention to that which they can meaningfully affect.
I think also it would be quite useful to play with the idea of recognising when it is that you're paying attention to something that's outside your sphere of influence, and endeavouring not to give it the same emotional charge that you of necessity give to the things that you're actually physically encountering in the world.
Certainly that's something that appears to be being done to us intentionally, that we appear to be constantly being provoked into seeing some tragedy that is beyond our influence, and our attention is intentionally drawn towards that which we cannot meaningfully alter.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean, with the Palestinian and the Syrian conflicts.
I mean, that's probably why now I don't watch any television, and I've given up even looking at the fronts of the newspapers, is because they are just completely scattered through with that stuff, and it's really difficult to get anything from the mainstream that doesn't have that content in it. And to a much more massive degree than when I was younger and the Vietnam War was on the telly, you really, really, really honestly wouldn't have seen, I don't know, you wouldn't see 5% of what you see on the news now every night.
I wonder how much, I know the sort of pubs are being closed by in their sort of minions, but I wonder how much of the discussion down the pub and the average pub over the course of the average evening is around those subjects which one has been given to think about, the likes of the Syrian conflict and the Tubby, go and scratch somewhere else, you bloody heathen.
That's it.
Yes, Nick's in your bed.
Off you go,
go and pester your mum or something.
She was actually sitting scratching right underneath the microphone with her nose more or less touching it. She's clearly a bit of a radio star at heart.
Yeah.
That one's distracted me. What were we talking about?
I have no idea. For God's sakes. Yes, so how many people down the pub?
Oh, right, yeah, well done.
Are going to be busy discussing, in great earnest, the situation in Syria, or in Greece, let's say, and who have absolutely no empowerment to be able to affect that situation.
Mm.
And how few discussions are about the pensioner three doors down, who possibly, you know what I mean, starving and freezing behind their nice glossy front door, who a simple delivery of a weekly meal would actually have a meaningful impact on their quality of life.
And that's the kind of thing that we're going to need to be engaging in, because I don't know about round here, but round us that sort of thing is just disappearing. Things like Meals on Wheels, all of it, it's all been handed over to volunteers.
Well, to some degree we have this sort of clamour for the protection of the welfare state, and yet to some extent the welfare state has been another psyop.
Well, that's what I meant. We need to be doing this anyway, but at the same,
welfare provisions should be coming from those of us within the society who are capable of providing.
The thing is that my argument would be, having looked at the example of Lammas,
excuse me,
certainly, having looked at the example of Lammas and some of the more successful land co-ops and stuff, if we weren't deprived of the use of the land and stuff, then you would be seeing communities that would be feeding their elders and including them in activities and stuff. I'm pretty sure that inclusive activities and all that kind of stuff would arise naturally, were we not having all of our time and 80% of what passes for our money taken off us and fed into traumatising us, basically.
Well, and also the constant magnification of youth culture through the lens of the redundant media.
Yes, yeah, which of course is another level of the invention, isn't it?
Of course, yeah.
And this is the real problem, I think, is that...
Who wants to see ugly people on the television? Excuse me, for God's sake. And of course, this joint is strong. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Excuse me. Well, I just whitey in the corner.
Well, I don't know about who wants to see ugly on the television, but when one is in a pub with television screens and they're flashing at you non-stop CNN news, all I can say is most of the people that are on that screen look bloody strange.
Mm.
You know? None of them look entirely comfortable with what they're doing, and I can't really say I'm surprised. And that's another thing that I think is important, is that when you're dealing with digital media and stuff, you're missing whole layers of communication that you would be having if you're actually listening to the person in the same room, which is one of the reasons why I really like the Truth Juice thing, because you can actually go along to a gathering or a night or whatever. And in the gatherings, anyway, you can hear four or five speakers a day, and you can meet them and you can talk to them afterwards. And, you know, it's so different. It's very difficult to assess things that you're getting through any kind of digital media on that kind of level, work out just whether to take it seriously or not.
Yeah, we're going back to authenticity.
Mm.
That legitimacy and authenticity are intricately tied together, and so if we are to believe that which we are being told, we have to know that the person that's speaking is authentic, and that somehow their words carry.
Yeah, and I love that particular point, because the thing is that once you know about the money and where it comes from and where it goes and what it is and therefore what taxes are, it changes one's view of everything because it all goes back to the money. So if the individual that you're listening to probably doesn't understand what the money is, then if he's talking about politics, local or national, or if he's talking about finance or banks or anything, and he's not giving you any indication of that fundamental understanding, then he really genuinely isn't in a position to be commenting. It's, you know, like your man, the quantum singularity guy, who says, you know, there's people who think like us.
Jesus Christ, excuse me.
I think we should put some tunes on and get some air going. Press the go tit on the Buffalo Skinners, man. This is you're to blame, which he is. It's his own fault. It is. That was the Sweet and Teenage Rampage, and if I'm lucky, I'll stop now. Yeah, well done. And as you can tell, I'm here with Jack. He's hosting for me tonight and showing me how the professionals
do it.
Thanks for that, Jack. He is now broadcasting to us wirelessly from his iron lung in the bathroom. We're hoping we can limp our way along for another 15 minutes of chat or so before playing out with some tunes. Do you think you're going to make it that far, Jack?
I'm not sure. I'll keep sucking and blowing and see where we get.
So, excellent. Actually, as I say, I find it extremely comfortable to think that I'm actually some sort of digital virtual hologram and that, you know, this is something running and it could be anything running tomorrow, really.
For me, the fascination comes with the fact that we appear to experience a fairly consensus approximation of each other's reality.
Yeah.
And that's where the real... If we are these individuated consciousness units and part of some kind of an uber soul of sorts, then it's all the more fascinating to me that we should be designed to project our own reality and yet seem to be so engaged with each other's variant on that.
I like one of Juliet's phrases, which was it's come from me, hang on a moment. We're here to experience the use and abuse of power in order that we may choose to choose love.
Yeah, that's pretty much the love bit. We actually come up against my problem with Tom Campbell's work, is that he constantly refers back to this. He, in fact, scientifically quantifies the concept of love.
Oh, right.
Meh. My correction to Campbell's work is to replace love and evil with beneficence and obsolescence.
Fair enough.
And for me, that is a really fundamental rewriting of the whole theory, the whole hypothesis, and alters the fundamental structure of the model. In so many different ways, and is a really important, vital difference.
It's all in the words.
What
were the two?
Beneficence and obsolescence.
Beneficence and obsolescence.
And we come to Shiva.
Yeah.
Shiva is the personification of beneficence and obsolescence. So the creator and the provider of all.
Yeah.
And the collector of all, which is no longer necessary. Yeah.
And if you really want to give it, if you really want to just stick with the human modality, you can still call it the positive and the negative of the current, can't you?
Of sorts,
And that's about as far as it goes.
Well, if you're in a condition where you believe that reality is a progression of unknown instances being created in that moment, in that instant of now, that there must be something at the back end of that system collecting all of the experience now and making sure that they don't just fill up all of reality with...
Here's something for you. I heard that, and this is something that I haven't checked out, but maybe you've come across. I just like it as an idea. We can treat it as a metaphor, might be true, might not. That apparently your octopuses and squids have got really advanced visual systems, actually capable of seeing many, many things that we can't see, even though it's pretty much completely dark where they are. Mm. And apparently they don't have a kind of brain for all these signals to go to. Nothing like the complexity that would be needed to actually process them. Which is really great. Where does it all go?
Well, for me, that's just simply a clear illustration that the brain is a... What do they call it? Oh, Jesus Christ. That mind is a...
God, it is getting late. Yeah.
Getting bloody late. Yeah.
Mind arises from brain or brain.
It is a resultant effect.
Yeah.
So mind is what you experience from having a brain that's doing calculations.
Yeah.
And I would suggest that the analogy of the squid eye and the squid neural system without a brain is a clear illustration that there's something going on that isn't a clear brain equals mind, mind equals brain analogy. That mind and brain are two completely different things, and that one is not necessarily a resultant of the other.
So you mean you don't get cleverer the bigger your brain gets?
It's entirely possibly completely unconnected.
Mm.
The brain may simply be a mechanism for sorting the input from a complex of nervous inputs, and so simply the size of the brain may equate to the number of inputs.
Well, when you think about it, the actual system itself that's carrying the brain around, with all of its lungs and its kidneys and all of these little veins that have to get longer and thinner as they get closer to the tips and all of that, and then you get your endocrine system managing all the energy, and in that there's this kind of hypothalamus thing that's itself a kind of myriad of self-referencing non-real-time sort of cascading systems. It's just like that actual automated system itself is really pretty fucking impressive. It's an amazing taxi.
I was going to say, the belief in oneself is possibly an irrational belief in and of itself, because if you know anything about the organism that you believe that you're carried around in, it's so unfathomably unrealistic to imagine a mechanism by which that organism can have arrived, that it can only be assumed reasonably, and through Occam's razor, be assumed to be a figment of your imagination.
It's that complex that it can't be real, is that what you're saying?
Basically, it's a far more reasonable assumption to begin as a starting assumption.
When you actually consider that possibly only about 10 or 15% of you is actually you, the rest of it's kind of zoo. It's a bunch of stuff that lives there too.
Well, certainly as far as your DNA is concerned, there's much more not you than there is you, as far as DNA is concerned, in your body. You know, 95% of the DNA in your body is not human.
Great. So basically
we're a colony. We're not an organism.
I'm a hyperdimensional light entity, why should I worry? Seems to be a pretty safe approach to me. It does, though, generally, seriously, just because we are, just before we kind of slip into some tunes, running into the end of the show, I reckon, it is a matter of taking yourself seriously, isn't it, Jack?
Taking oneself seriously with one's tongue firmly planted in one's cheek because it would appear that this entire thing is constructed as a playground for us to experience the magnitude parameters that are available to us within the rule set that's configured for this reality. And that's really, you know, I mean, that's really what we're playing with here, is what exactly is that goddamn rule set? What are the parameters within which the reality that we experience are confined by?
Are there any parameters?
I think that there has to be. I think that in order for reality to be intelligible, in order for us to assemble tomorrow from the results of today, etc., there have to be logical constraints placed upon the playground in which our minds are allowed to explore.
Great. Yeah, I guess that's a fair assumption. Quite a lot of it doesn't seem very logical to me, but I'll take what you're saying as written. Well, I reckon that we've, I kind of stumbled in here about just an hour or so before the show started. I reckon we've earned the right to play some tunes and drink a bit more beer and hang out. And
we can come back and revisit some of the subjects on the Psychonautilus.
Yeah, that'd be really good. I'll be on the Psychonautilus. And, if you are going to pass on, I'd rather you did it on your own show. But it's really, really brilliant, Jack Tar, for letting me in, and to everybody for feeding me. That's really cracking. And for doing all the excellent hosting. And also thanks to, I'll say hi to Norman over there in Minnesota, who listens to the podcast. Met him whilst I was in Glastonbury. That's really great, meeting somebody from the States who recognises me. Norman, 10 out of 10 to you, mate. And the lovely Jasmine from Hawaii as well, who's also a fairly frequent listener and recognised Synchro as well, which is really great. So we're like a fart in a spacesuit, we're spreading. So I'll be back with Jack on Friday, which is tomorrow. At 9 o'clock, when Jack will be doing the music, and perhaps I'll get to press his buttons. In the meantime, ta to everybody for listening, and to autonomousmedia.net, and to everybody in the chat box, and everybody who catches up with us on the pod and can keep up.
Yeah, God knows. good luck with that one.
Yeah, good luck with that one, indeed. To old Gets shooting the breeze. Thanks for listening, folks. We're going to be listening to Leonard Skinner's Call Me the Breeze, and then a few other pretty well-known tunes that you should all not need explaining. Thanks for being there. See you next week when I'll be coming live from Bristol, where hopefully we're going to be doing a Radical Roots kind of guerrilla food-growing community type show prior to going into a Fire in the Mountain financial meeting, followed by a Fire in the Mountain party with the John Langan Band. So Dr. Rock live in Bristol might even be a bonus show in there somewhere. Excellent stuff. See you, folks. Leonard Skinner, Call Me the Breeze. As long as you don't infringe my rights, you can call me what you like.
See you tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.